Saul is the first king of Israel. sorry. So the story goes like this, we'll be picking up in 1 Samuel, probably starting at around chapter 8. The story kind of goes like this. The Israelites start looking around and seeing all the other nations around them, and they said, you know what, we would like to have a king too. Can you give us a king? And Samuel, who last week I said he was a prophet, he's actually the last judge. He was the last judge along the line of judges. He's like, you don't want a king. You don't want to do this. And the people are like, no, we do. We really want a king. We want to be like the other nations. And then God says, fine, give them a king. They're not rejecting you, Samuel, as a judge, but they're rejecting me as their king. Now, for a lot of us, we've probably heard this before. We've heard that the Israelites rejected God as their king and decided to have a king for themselves. But what you might not know is actually God knew that this was probably going to happen already. Kingship was actually always part of God's plan. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, it actually says, and I'll read this out, Deuteronomy chapter 17, starting from verse 14. When you come to the land that the Lord is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. So even Moses' last kind of words in Deuteronomy, he's already saying, look, you as a nation, you're going to want a king. But I will bring the king at the right time, and I'm going to bring the right kind of king. In other words, you have to trust me. He then goes on in Deuteronomy chapter 17 for the next couple of verses to talk about what that king should be like. And picking up from verse 18, he says, and when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book of with a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So God already sets out in the first five books of the Bible, in Deuteronomy, what it means to be a king of Israel, which meant you still follow God. In fact, you have the law, but the law is God's law. And the king is this example of what it means to follow him. What happens, though, is the Israelites don't really wait for this time to come. And the first thing I want to kind of bring up is that actually we need to trust God's word. See, this was already written down in Deuteronomy, and yet the people had forgotten it. In fact, even when Saul comes along, he's not this kind of king. And even when Samuel goes through this with Saul and he talks about the law and what it means to be a king, Saul forgets this. For us, actually, as Christians, the hardest thing for us to do is actually to say, okay, God, I'm going to trust your word. I'm going to trust your Bible. I want to seek it. I want to understand it. I want to trust you. A lot of times the way we want to read the Bible is you kind of like flip through, look for a verse that we like, pick it, and then run off with it and say, well, this is now what I'm going to feel, and this is a great promise that I have, and I'm going to hold on to it. And it might be true, actually, that promise is probably very strong from God. It's probably contextually, it might be okay. But sometimes what it means to trust God's word is to listen to even the parts that challenge us, that convict us, that contradict the way the world is kind of working. And that's hard for us to do. And what we'll see as we go through the story of Saul is that actually trusting God or learning to trust God and learning to trust his word is what we're called to be or how we're called to live. So let's pick up and look at Saul's life. The first thing is actually comparing yourself with others is not going to satisfy you. And as we come to Saul, we'll see that actually one of the things he's doing is kind of looking at the people around him. But very first, picking up from 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 1, it says, but the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. What's happening here is what I kind of said before. The Israelites are asking for a king, and they're kind of looking around. And they're looking at all the other nations and saying, look, they have someone to judge them. They have power. They have these kind of things. We want that too. God, can you give that to us as well? And of course, here it says, God says, yep, okay, fine. They want that. When you go further along the passage, it says, look, this is what it's going to do. Tell them the truth of what it means to have a king. And Samuel goes back to them and says, look, if you have a king, he's going to tax you. He's going to put your people into labor. It's not going to be what you think it's going to be like. They're like, we don't care. We still want one. And Samuel's like, well, it's on your head then. For me, looking at this, I understand that actually we don't have a strong immediate correlation because we're not crying out for a king in this country, actually. I think the only person who wants to be king is the guy who would be king, but his mom doesn't want to let him be king yet. And for us to understand politically, it's kind of a difficult thing. I guess something more similar would be right now with Hong Kong trying to hold on to democracy, where China's trying to encroach on that. But that's still kind of distant for us, too, because we're kind of living in a democracy. And I think the better example is when we see someone else that we know and it looks like they have a better life than us, where they look like things are happier. And when we're watching their lives and we're seeing what's going on in their life, we feel like, wow, their lives are really moving forward. Their lives are really exciting. But my life, it feels stuck or not producing. I feel jealous. What's actually happening here is that the Israelites are jealous of the other nations. We find out later that the Philistines have been kind of oppressing the Israelites for a while. They've been in battle. And one of the things is that they used to have to go to the Philistines to have them make metal. So they didn't have any of their own kind of metallurgists or forgers. So they had to go there, pay extra money. So they're looking at these people around them and saying, wow, they have all these things. If we had a king, if we had that kind of power, if we could make other countries look at us, then we would have this kind of, you know, recognition as well. For us, it's the same kind of thing sometimes. When we're too busy looking at what other people have, that we become dissatisfied and frustrated with our own life. I think the most recent studies coming out of Facebook, apart from the ones they're doing illegally without your knowledge, coming out of Facebook and also Flickr, is they say looking at people's lives on Facebook or Flickr, when you see the pictures of people having fun, actually makes you more unhappy because you see all these people having fun, whereas your life is you're actually just scrolling through your newsfeed. And you feel jealous, and you think, like, well, why are these people all at this party, or why are all these people having this barbecue, and I'm here, you know, not doing this? There's a great kind of video making the rounds where some guy starts making up stories about himself, like, oh, I'm having a lot of fun doing this. In Japan, they actually have this guy discovered that he could take selfies of himself, and he puts fingernail polish on his other hand, so he looks like he's out on a date with a girl. It's called like single dating, where he's literally just out and he puts his hand out like this, and he'll take a picture, so it looks like he's on a date with a girl. And he has a whole series of these photos, and they look really good. You're like, wow, are you sure he's not with someone? But it's not. Then he'll show a picture of himself just putting his hand there, and you're like, wow, this is Japanese. I think it's Japanese. It might be Taiwanese, though, so I don't know. It could be my people. It could be Americans. No, not really. And so when we start looking at other people's lives jealously, we become very dissatisfied. So this happened to me this week, actually. So I'm like, I guess kind of understand this. People talk to me about this sometimes. Like, oh, I see my friend, he got promoted. Or, like, I feel like I'm in a dead-end job. I'm not going anywhere. And I look at all these people, and their lives are going someplace. And what's the big deal? So this happened to me this week. I had a friend come by who's just moved to Hong Kong. Yeah, if I talk about this enough, everyone's those who know him will know who I'm talking about. So he comes over. He's like, he's visiting from Hong Kong. He started working for a church there. And he said, oh, let me come up and we'll hang out together and just catch up. And so I kind of used to mentor him, just kind of keep an eye on him because he just started working for a church here. And it's like, they need support. There aren't a lot of people in Chinese churches. Someone's got to help him. So I was giving him some tour. He comes up and he starts talking to me like, oh, yeah, it's just really great in my church in Hong Kong. You know, it's really super. And, you know, it's so much support. And I got to meet all these, like, really other famous theologians. And we just all hang out together. And, like, all the Bill Johnson, all these really big name people. I'd be honest, I didn't know who he was talking about. But they sounded really important. And I think that's what matters more. Because he's, like, listing them off. Like, and apparently, if you want to seem like an expert in your field and also make people jealous, list off names of other experts in the field. And the other person will immediately feel... I read this in a report somewhere. So he started listing off these things. And said, oh, yeah, and then I sat down for an hour and just picked this guy's brain. And then back at our church is really great. And, you know, we have this amazing sound desk. And I was sitting there listening to him. And, like, I'm fighting this feeling of, like, oh, yeah, I'm really happy for you, man. I really bless you. That's great to hear how good it's going. And the other half of me is like, oh, what am I doing? Man, I would never really move to Hong Kong, so I could never really say I could be out there doing that. But there's that jealousy creeping in my heart, and I was like, oh, God, yeah, exactly. What am I doing? What is the measure of my life? You know, look at these people, and they're doing such exciting, great stuff. And as he was talking, I had to really stop and pray and say, okay, God, let me just love my brother and appreciate and love what he's going through and not be jealous. And that's a really hard battle to have. And it's really hard to actually stop at that moment to say, you know what, I'm not going to hold this and compare myself to them, but rather I'm going to celebrate in what's going on with his life. Now, when that happens to you, when you start to celebrate, I'll tell you how the first thing we do when we try to celebrate someone's good stuff is this is how we do it. We say, wow, that's really great. In the back of your head, you're saying, yeah, just wait till it gets bad. It's not going to be like this always. You've just been there for a year. I'm happy for you for now. The worst part being for now, because we're kind of like waiting for the impending doom when it will get bad. But as I started doing that and I started feeling like, no, Bert, that's not celebrating in him. That's still being jealous, and you're just being passive-aggressive now in your head. So I had to stop and say, actually, you know what? This is really great for him. You know, it's really encouraging. And the only way I could do that was to say this: God, your name is being glorified in amazing ways in Hong Kong. That is awesome. And God, I want, you know, you to keep doing that and keep multiplying that. When you start being able to see things not from a self perspective, but starting seeing things from not their perspective, from God's perspective, it really sets you free to celebrate. See, when you're comparing yourself with others, it's all very on a surfacely horizontal level. But when you bring God into the picture, and you look at God, and you see what he's done for your life, and you're seeing what he's doing there, and what he's doing in the world around you, you're like, actually, wow. You know, praise God. I'm really happy for you. And so, like, even if it's your friend who got a promotion, and at first you're like, oh, I feel like I work so much harder than you. You know, like, I never get promoted. It's because I'm a Chinese girl, isn't it? And that's like, I'm never going to move up this corporate ladder. I'm not really a Chinese girl. I'm pretending. We have this sense where, like, we're blocked off or we're closed. But when you stop and say, well, actually, God, you know, you're the one who opens these doors. And you know what? This person actually, you know, they have their other struggles. God, I just want you to bless them. Starting to stop comparing ourselves with others actually sets us free to live our life. Sets us free to engage in life and to celebrate God. With the Israelites at this time, they are looking around. They're seeing what other people have. And you can't help but think they're comparing their nation with everyone else's nation. And my friend from Singapore used to do this all the time. He actually had an index. He had made his own database, Excel spreadsheet, of everyone's GDP. And he's awesome. I love this guy. He would map out every month. He'd get the GDP for the nations. And he'd say, ooh, Singapore's GDP has gone down a little bit. can he compare it? And he'd be like, I'd be like, dude, that's really intense. You put a lot of effort. No, it's just I just want to compare my nation with the others, just to feel, just to know how things are going. And the part of me said, wow, you're really Jiangsu. But in the end, he stopped doing that because he decided that he really wanted to pursue stuff that God's doing. And instead of using that, creating a spreadsheet for how to track GDP, he started to track a spreadsheet of countries around him that don't know God, and trying to figure out ways that he can get involved in that. And he said the same kind of technical ability, but using it in a different way, because he thought, well, actually, I want to be used by you to bless people. And then that kind of heart, to me, really shifts the perspective. When you're not comparing on this level, but letting God begin to teach your heart. And what we're going to start talking about today is, God, show my heart what it means to be like yours, to see that kind of way. The second thing that we see is actually what this world wants, that's the first one. Comparing yourself to this world is going to make you dissatisfied. The second thing is, what this world wants isn't always right. So back then in that time in the ancient Near East, the way that you would be picked for any positions of power was based pretty much on your physical ability or how tall you were. And so when Saul was chosen as king, in 1 Samuel chapter 9, they actually talk about what he's like, and I'll read it from verse 1, 1 Samuel chapter 9. There was a man of the tribe of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Becherath, son of Athaiah, a Benjamite, a man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upwards, he was taller than any of the people. So there's two things here. One, he was really, really good looking. Secondly, he was taller than everyone else, which meant that he stood out. He was distinct. He was special. And he was also really, really good looking. And I think handsome also probably meaning that he was also in very good shape. He's probably hench, able to do amazing things. And this is how people would decide, you know, who was important. And for Samuel to pick Saul as king made sense for the people, because he took the biggest and the strongest and the best looking person. And so that made sense to all the kingship. Except God kind of demonstrates, look, just because what looks good on the outside, or just because everyone else in the world is doing this, doesn't make that the best option. And what's actually really sad about Saul is Saul ends up reflecting all the weaknesses of Israel itself. All the kind of polarity that goes on that you see in Judges between following God and disobeying him, that's all the same kind of stuff you see in Saul's life. And Saul himself ends up completely confused of trying to please people and trying to serve God, in the end, where he just kind of loses it. What God was more concerned with was the heart or the character of someone, what's on their inside. And he actually says later, look, I need to put someone to be a king who has the same heart as mine. If we think back to that Deuteronomy chapter 17 passage, it says, the one who fears the Lord's, who knows the Lord's law. In other words, it's looking for someone who has that same heart or same passion for God. Now, that's very different to kind of what the world sort of sells out to us or pitches to us a lot of times. I guess this world is much more concerned with what's on the outside than what's on the inside. I think recently we might have heard about that that Chinese couple, and they got married, and then the kids came out, and they were really ugly kids. And the husband decided he's going to divorce his wife because she had so much plastic surgery. He felt like he was lied to because the kids came out ugly. And it's a sad thing. It's kind of funny, but it's also kind of really sad state of humanity, because actually that is kind of the world that we're living in now, where the outside or the look is now so important that people are disregarding and passing by what's in the heart or what really comprises of a character or of a person. we're actually coming to a place more. And I actually didn't ask Fan if I could share this story, but she's in work. Oh, she can hear me. Oh, she's gonna come out now. Hi, honey. No, I'm just gonna share it, and then she'll hear it on the podcast this week in the car. Yeah. Hi, honey. I love you. All right. Okay. I was waiting for Kay to look at me and make eye contact. But they don't have the sound on in there. All right. So this a little while ago, she's in work, and they're having kind of this argument about a parking pass. So they feel like, okay, so, you know, car park spaces in a workplace are precious. Everyone's kind of arguing. So some people have been using this car park space, not exactly legally. You're not supposed to. So, you know, what they do is they'll swipe someone in, then pass the card out to the person behind them and let that person swipe through as well. And kind of like get an extra car in there. Chinese mentality is like, yeah, nothing wrong with that. Anyways, something's wrong with it. So, and then they kind of find out about, and then there's factions within the office. You know, it's always like there's always some people that don't like someone else and like, they're doing this. They shouldn't be allowed to do this. And plus, you know, Fan, you need this pass, actually, because you've got to go out. You've the site visits. You should tell the boss to get the pass so that you can use it for yourself. And then Fan comes in like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like, then there's, like, pressure on the sides. And I said, well, just, as I told Sarah, just be honest, right? Say, look, tell those guys they probably shouldn't be using the pass for that. Tell the boss that, actually, you don't need the pass for your own parking thing, because they were trying to say you should just take the pass and use it yourself. And Fan's like, well, I don't need the pass, actually. It's fine. I come so early, I get a parking space. So there's kind of like this political drama, this kind of intrigue. And then she ends up telling them, and they're like, and the boss finds out, and he's like, okay, well, you can't use the pass anymore. No one gets to use the pass. And then Fan's like, okay, well, that's fine, it's all settled then. Then later on, they're trying to get Fan to do something she doesn't feel comfortable with. And then they say, oh, wait, I know why you won't do it. It's because you have morals. You're not a team player. Which sounds harsh, but also sounds very normal. Because that's kind of the way the world thinks, right? In here, it's not so bad. But if you go to Malaysia, like, oh, you don't take that bribe, what's wrong with you? You're not a team player, you're not working for the company. In the American political system, oh, you're not working with these people trying to give you money? What's wrong with you? You're not really helping. You're not a team player. And so, you know, Fan comes over, she's like, oh, what? I feel bad. I feel bad like I didn't do this thing. I said, you shouldn't feel bad. They're wrong. You've got to live right. You've got to trust God that this is the better way to go. And see, that's actually our greatest challenge as Christians, to trust God that there's a better way to live. Even if in the short term, or even if in the present, it doesn't feel like it. You have to understand, for the Israelites, they did not feel like their country was good. They did not feel like they were able to survive. They were struggling. But they should have held on. They should have trusted God. Saul is interesting, because it's the idea of embracing distinction. See, Saul's really interesting because actually he is very distinct. He's handsome and he's tall. But he never seems totally settled into this. And even being called king seems to put him in a very awkward place. In 1 Samuel chapter 10, so this is Samuel's already anointed Saul and said, look, you're going to be king. It's a great story, too, because actually Saul's like, oh, our donkeys are lost. Let's go look for our donkeys. So him and his friend go look for their donkeys. They can't find the donkeys. And they're like, oh, there's a prophet up there. While we're here, we might as well ask him where the donkeys are. So he goes up, and then Samuel sees this guy. Samuel's the prophet up there. He's like, oh. And then God says, this guy's the guy that's going to be king. And so Saul walks up there, and he's like, oh, hey. And Samuel says, your donkeys are fine. They've gone back home. Come, you're going to eat with us now. And then he takes him to a room, anoints him, tells him everything, says, you're going to be king. And Saul always seems to be wrestling with this responsibility, this thing that makes him distinct, and just trying to be like everyone else. And he doesn't ever know that balance, which is funny, because that's the same as Israelites' problem, right? They're distinct as God's called them to be, but they're always uncomfortable with that. And if you think about it, that's the same as us as Christians, isn't it? We're called to be distinct, but we're still trying so hard to be part of the world. We want to be relevant and cool, but at the same time, distinct. And we can't find that balance. Where actually God is saying, no, embrace what makes us distinct. And what makes us distinct isn't on the outside, it's the heart, right? Embrace the heart of Christ, and that distinction will shape the world around you. You've got to trust God in this. So I was saying, actually, the passage about Saul is funny. In 1 Samuel chapter 10, then Samuel brought all the tribes, starting from verse 20, all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. So he's like now doing this thing where he's like, okay, we're going to cast lots, and this will affirm whether Saul is king. No one else knows Saul is going to be king, so they're casting lots from the tribe. So this is a public thing, so everyone can see and look and say, well, this guy, as we cast lots, God's going to lead us to the one who's going to be king. So he casts lots. They find out it's going to be the tribe. The guys come from the tribe of Benjamin. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near its clans, and the clan of Matrites was taken by lot. So out of that, the tribe inside Benjamin, Matrites, was taken by the lot. So they're like, okay. Then Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. So they say, okay, well, the guy who's going to be king is Saul. And then they start looking for him. They're like, where's Saul? Now, this is hilarious because everyone knows you're kind of picking a king. And Saul knows that actually he's going to win this. But where is he? They can't find him anywhere. But when they saw him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, is there a man still to come? And the Lord said, behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage. So this is Saul. He's been chosen to be king. Samuel's already told him it. As they're casting lots to kind of prove it, he goes and he hides because he doesn't want to be called out. He doesn't want to be distinct. He doesn't want this thing. So he's hiding among the baggage. So much that's really funny, right? Because they're like, did we get the wrong guy? Should we cast lots again? Let's have a recount, right? And then God's like, no, he's hiding in the baggage. Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among his people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upwards. And Samuel said to all the people, do you see him who the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people. And all the people shouted, long live the king. Now, I have to admit, being tall is not something I understand well. The only people I'm a shoulder above taller are children until the age of 9. And then it's true, though. I mean, a whole head taller. So I don't have this understanding. But the tall people that I do hang around, I do know something a lot of times about them is that a lot of times they kind of hunch over, which you would think a short person would always be like this, but no. And one of the reasons is because sometimes a lot of the tall people I know, they don't like standing out. There's this awkwardness. And there's an interview with John Amechi, who is one of the British basketball players who actually made it to the NBA. And he said, it's really hard being tall. People are always looking at you. You can't hide anywhere if you're tall. I guess the tall people are laughing. It's just Francis. So, I just highlighted you. Embrace your distinction, man. Embrace your distinction. There are other tall people here. It's all relative to me, though. Technically, everyone's taller. And then there's this thing, like, so John Amici was talking about this, like, you know, and I can't go anywhere. I feel like a misfit. Like everyone's always staring at me. And that was always kind of his issue. And you see, actually, if this guy in the tribe of the Israelites, if he is a whole head taller than everyone else, he's going to have that as well, that sort of complex. But actually, what God is saying, look, that on the physical part, you are a head taller. But if your heart, if your life, if your inner soul is a head taller, and you embrace that distinction, the impact you make on the world around you is significant. And actually, even as this guy, if he were a king and he embraced the fact that actually God has made me in this special way to lead this kingdom, he would have treated it completely different. All the character studies of King Saul kind of point out one of his big things is kind of his insecurity. He's always kind of trying to figure out whether to please people or just to please God. But one of the big things to combat insecurity is to know where your security lies, to, in this case, embrace Christ, embrace God. For him, he doesn't know Christ yet. For us, it is the same thing. Look, God, you have made me this way. God, let my heart be changed more and more to have your desires, to have your love of people, of justice, of goodness, of what's right, to live that way. It's funny because actually, from this point on, Saul, after he's chosen king, just keeps making a series of mistakes one after another. And some of the most... it's funny because he keeps trying to be a strong leader and making bold statements, then having to retract them later because he's not trusted God or he's not really sought God. And then the last thing is, you've got to know God. You've got to trust God, and you've got to love him. For Saul, he didn't actually know God that well. And because he didn't know God, he wouldn't trust him. He didn't want to trust God with his things. And so two of the big things that kind of happened were Samuel said, look, you go to this place first, wait 7 days, and then I'll come, and then we'll do a sacrifice. It gets pretty brutal. Okay, so what happens is there's kind of a battle. Saul gets a man. Jonathan goes down. They kill an outpost. All the Philistines get really upset, and so they come and they kind of surround them. Let me pick up from here for Samuel. Saul chose chapter 12. Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan, Saul's son, in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And all of Israel heard it said that Saul had defeated the garrisons of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. So you have this thing, they kind of set up their troops, 3,000 people, 2,000 with Saul, 1,000 here. This first army with Jonathan, they end up defeating the troops. Saul sounds the trumpet to say, like, look, kind of war is coming. We've won this first kind of battle. You know, rally the troops together. Follow me. Meanwhile, in verse 5, and the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. They came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth Avon. I think some people say whether those numbers are figurative, like they're kind of just to demonstrate the immensity of it. Maybe. I think the key point to point out is that there were a lot more of them, and they had chariots. Up until now, you have to understand technology in terms of warfare, chariots and actually horses, training kind of horses and spears and all that metal, that was really big technology back then. That's the equivalent of us having drones that can go out and kill people today. So for them to have this put them at a completely different leverage. And you're talking about a lot more troops compared to untrained kind of soldiers. The other thing we find out later is that because Israelite doesn't really have any metallurgists or forgers, they don't have swords and spears either really that much. Okay, so you're talking about not really going to win this battle, are they? Naturally, Saul begins to panic. He's like, okay, well, we're now surrounded by all these troops and chariots, and I've got to wait here for 7 days until Samuel comes back and tells me what to do, and we have a sacrifice. So during the 7 days, everyone starts getting more and more nervous. Everyone starts kind of panicking. People start deserting the king. Now, again, if we go back and we think of King Saul's kind of temperament, his kind of thinking, talking about his insecurities, he's like totally freaking out now. And then he waited for 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he had commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." He just panics. And it's not a surprise. Completely outnumbered. You cannot see a physical way to kind of win this battle, to change the tide of things. And he's waiting here for Samuel. Now, it's funny, he says he waits for 7 days, and Samuel's not there, so he decides, I'm just going to do the sacrifices myself. Now, this is a big deal. All right, for us, it's like, it doesn't sound like a big deal. It's a big deal because, actually, the sacrifices were only supposed to be done by the prophets or the priests. And for him to do it was him kind of saying, look, I don't trust these guys. They're not here. I don't trust God. I've got to do it myself. And so by him doing this sacrifice, what he's trying to do is force God's hand. He's trying to say, look, now I've done this. You have to tell me what to do next. He's trying to say, I'm in control. God, you have to listen to me. Samuel comes and says, look, what are you doing here? Later in 1 Samuel 15, actually says, you know, look, to obey God is better than to sacrifice. In this case, sacrifice being performing some ritual just to try to look good or look strong, to try to force God to do something. Let me give you an example of this. So some of you might have, all right, so last week at BCC, so we kind of started service kind of on time, and there's like nobody here. There's like a few people here, two of them were new. And the rest were serving. And then I threw out this thing on Facebook, like, okay, I need to get advice from other people. How do you get people to come to church on time? And so some people were like, all Noah's Ark, lock the doors. Obviously, fire hazard, not going to do that. Other people were like, bring more food, bribe them to come in. I'm like, I don't think that's going to be enough because that's... people can buy their own food, actually. They'll just eat at home. So I'm like, I don't know what to do. And then other people are like trying to convince me, no, it's just a Chinese cultural thing. You know, if you're going to treat it like a family, you want it to be relaxed. I'm like, okay, that's cool, whatever. And then as I was looking at this passage, I thought, well, actually, this is probably a good example of obedience and sacrifice. So, because sometimes we think, well, obey means you would come here at time because I told you to come here on time, right? So obedience would mean that. But actually, that's not true. If I commanded you to be here on time and you were here on time, but you were angry and frustrated and bitter and you had to have a massive fight with your kids in the car just to get here on time, that's actually not the obedience that God desires. That's actually sacrifice. You've just performed some action to come here on time, hoping that somehow that would make it right. See, actually what obedience is that God's talking about is obedience to the heart. When you know God, when you trust God, when you love God, when you obey him that way, you're responding out of the heart as opposed to bitterness. And thinking about that, even as a pastor, I would much rather have people come to church not having fought with everyone else on the way, shouting at cars, swearing at them, trying to rush to church, but rather to come here, hearts prepared, saying, you know, look, God, I want to worship you. I'm expectant to see what you're doing. When we start breaking it down that way, saying, actually, obedience to God means, God, let my heart be prepared for you. Let me trust in you. But we're so used to sacrifice, actually, trying to perform something or do a task that somehow means then, okay, God, I'm good enough. And I can imagine some of us being like, seeing God later, but God, I showed up to church on time every single day, every single Sunday for the past 5 years. But where is the love? Where is the depth of that relationship? Where is the heart? That's what's happening with Saul. He is performing an action, but his heart is lost. He's panicking. He doesn't know where to go. He doesn't know what to believe in. He doesn't know what to hold on to. When we talk about obedience over sacrifice, the question is, where is your heart at? Are you putting your heart into God and trusting him and seeking him? You're not just doing stuff for the sake of doing it. That's an empty heart. And I realize actually our struggle is, and I'm not talking about being late or on time anymore, our struggle with our faith is actually that our hearts are empty. If we struggle to connect with God, if we struggle to know God, it's because they're empty. We don't know what it is that we should be hungering for or looking for or expectant of. And what we need to do is to ask God, God, fill my heart with your desires. Fill my heart with what you see. Fill my heart with this expectancy of worship. It's a very different perspective when you start saying, actually, I'm excited because I want God to show me today in my workplace, in my family. I want him to fill my heart so that I see what he sees in my family, what he sees in my workplace. God, fill my heart. Teach me and show me. In Proverbs 4:23, it says, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the springs of life. It's actually this idea that actually God is saying, yes, let your heart be filled with my living water. And from there, your actions will flow. So there's three things to kind of end with. The first is to actually examine your heart. You stop and say, actually, God, what is the wrong in my heart? What are the areas which I'm thinking and looking the wrong way? In other words, what are the things that, like Saul, I'm turning away from you from? Where I'm choosing my own thing, where I'm acting out of insecurity? God, examine my heart so that I can repent and I can say, sorry, I don't want to live like that anymore. Well, and the second thing then is to ask God to clean it and ask him to change your desires and motivations. And the way I broke this down was, well, the first thing is, well, actually, God, is there something in my daily routine in my life that needs to be changed? Is there something in my habits or my attitudes that needs to be shifted? And I thought of this because I was thinking about how much time I spend, you know, with my phone. Like, I'm in a deep love relationship with my smartphone, as many of you probably are. And it's amazing how much time you can waste on it. But it's one of those things where you stop and say, okay, God, well, am I letting this dictate my life a little bit more than it needs to? God, show me. Show me what to change. Fill my heart with something else. Because I realize the more time I spend with something else that's not right, I fill up my heart with that. But actually, I'm asking God, well, actually, fill it with what's right. I'm not saying throw your smartphones in the rubbish bin or something like that, but you're asking, actually, God, you show me. God, you teach me. The second thing is, what does he want you to change in the way you treat others? In other words, instead of looking at the way the world sees the things, you're actually asking God, show me how to see people with your eyes. One of the biggest things that we hear a lot is people always praying that someone else will be changed. God, you know, I'm really frustrated with this person. Can you change them to make them know you? And it's the worst because it's like you're a Christian and you're frustrated with someone who's not a Christian, and you're saying, God, change them so that they can know your love, so that they can be a better person. Where actually God's like, he doesn't know who I am. You do. Maybe you should ask what you should change in your life. And it's a hard prayer to say, where actually, God, I'm really frustrated with this person. What needs to change in my life, in my relationship? What needs to change with me? It's crazy too, because you think, well, no, but see, God, I'm not about trying to change me. I'm trying to help you change that other person. God's saying, I'm not trying to help you to ask you to help me to change the other person. I need to change you. And my mom is a good example of this, because we spent so many years praying for my dad to become a Christian. And then it was only like later when my mom said, oh, actually, you know what? God just started to change my heart that I need to change. I need to make the change to be more loving, to be more patient, to be more gracious to my husband. And it's like, oh, that's such a weird, does it seem backwards? Like, instead, we should be praying that they are converted. But actually, God's like, no, the conversion will come when you are following me, when your heart is right with me. Trust me. And asking God to say, okay, well, show me, God, what needs to be changed in the way I treat others. And thirdly is, and we've been talking about this, and you see this actually over things, God, what are my dreams and desires? What needs to be changed? What needs to be put aside to trust in you? It's funny because actually the older I get, the more I realize how important it is that I have God show me what to do. Raising kids, you have no idea what you're doing, what's going on, and there's always like there's so much, what school do they go to? What instruments do they play? Am I being too strict? Am I not being strict enough? Am I going to look back 10 years from now and wish that I had forced them to do a lot more Chinese? Like, I don't know. And it's one of those things where you have to start saying, God, actually, God, let me trust you. Fill my heart with your desires for my child. Fill your heart with the love that you want me to have for my child. Because that doesn't mean then I'm like, because sometimes we think, oh, love for your child just means you just shower them with gifts. That's not what it means. Actually, God is saying, no, they need to be doing this. You need to teach them about my love in this way. You need to demonstrate in your life the power of God. And as I've read through a lot of the studies about how kids end up still being Christians from their parents, it doesn't come down to the church as much as it comes down to the life that their parents live and the relationship with God that they see in their parents' lives. That is the biggest determinant, actually. They also found that if your grandparents are also followers of Christ, that makes a huge difference in the child's life too, which blew me away. I didn't think that was going to happen in the study, but apparently both the grandparents and the parents play a big role in that. When they see the reality of Christ in your life, that's where you'll see that change. And finally, the last thing to do is after examining your heart and asking God to clean your heart is to obey, is to live, is to walk and to act in that way instead of just giving up. Learning to trust God in that way. When I think back about Saul's life, and it's really easy to stand as you read the Bible and kind of judge and look at their mistakes and think how foolish it is. But when you start to see actually how close it is to our own lives, like I feel like there's so many times I'm moving out of insecurity, where I'm panicking, where I'm unsure of what to do. And instead of waiting and seeking God, I start rushing around and making a mess of it. There's that moment when you start to realize, actually, God, I need you a lot more than I think I did. Some things that we're seeing as we're going through the Old Testament is God is very keen on teaching us to trust him, but that he is true and faithful, that we can always trust him because he's the only one worthy to be trusted. The second thing as we've been going through the Old Testament is finding actually one of the God things God really wants to teach us is patience. Now, it's really closely related, right? How do you learn to trust someone? Well, patience. Why? Because that's time invested in someone. When you discover what it means to be patient with God, to trust him, to wait, you discover how faithful he is in an overwhelming way. The third thing that we're discovering as we go through the Old Testament is that Jesus saves us. So for Saul, he was kind of a king at the wrong time. He wasn't allowed to make sacrifices. But Jesus, he's the perfect king. He's the perfect king, prophet, priest. The one who is able to do all these things eternally for us. And the perfect example. Whereas Saul was a reflection of Israel at the time, Jesus is a reflection of who we are being made into, of what we are going to be like in heaven. Shall we pray? Lord, we thank you very much for your amazing love and your graciousness. You know, and we know that actually our hearts are filled with so much of our own desires and our own kind of ways of thinking. And in a lot of ways, I think we need a reformation or a revolution in our thinking, in our attitudes, in the way we treat and people, treat one another. So God, as we examine our hearts now, as we worship you, Lord, let your spirit and your presence just wash over us and convict us and open our eyes to specific things, Lord, things that need to be taken out of our hearts and filled with you. And we don't want to walk around in our lives so empty, trying to pursue things that bring such empty satisfaction, Lord, but we desire you. God, and we need you. We need your teaching and your guidance and your love. So we look to you now, and as we come and worship, let your spirit challenge and convict us. In your name we pray. Amen. Let's come to a time of worship. We have a little bit longer worship now just for people to respond, both in your own personal prayer, or if you'd like, I think Sue's going to be up.